We are again. It's Sunday afternoon, 4 p.m. in beautiful New York City, I hope it's beautiful all over the world. And I just wanted to say thank you for all for joining me. I've got people on Facebook, people on YouTube, and people on BBS Radio. And those of you who have stuck around from Sri and Kira, I'm very, very pleased. A special welcome to you. Thank you for being here. And thank you for taking the opportunity to take some time out during your week and your Sunday to do inner exploration. For me, the meaning of everything is determined by our inner state, our inner quality. And while we spend a lot of time acquiring information, not just, you know, the mundane information, not the information, normal information we need for everyday life and, you know, to keep up on what's going on and the like, but the kind of thing that can only come from spending some contemplative time with ourselves. And you realize, of course, that the world, with all of its distractions and all of its demands, wants exactly the opposite. The last thing it wants you to be is contemplative and inward looking. And it kind of brings me to the theme for the show today, which is spiritual medicine. Because to me, after 40 plus, geez, almost 50 years really of being on the spiritual path, not quite 50 years, 45, and having explored many different modalities and many different ways of approaching it, one thing is imminently clear. While there's a million paths, there's one top to the mountain. And the answer to humanity's problems is, in fact, spiritual. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't organizational structural changes that need to take place. There are, and they do. But those are all going to grow out of a sense of an inner perception of what is intrinsically and innately true. And everybody thinks they know what the truth is. And when we think we know what the truth is, we kind of want to assert it. But in my experience, I found that the truth is something that is forever surprising me. And it's forever revising my perceptions of what truth is. And the moment I think that I have, this is it, I've arrived, I'm at the final spot now, I'm good, that's exactly when the time when truth pulls some card out of its sleeve and completely pulls the rug out from underneath me. And at first I found that very perplexing, because I thought that the whole point of life was to find this one fixed absolute truth that was never going to change. And that somehow that was a perception, that there was some kind of knowledge, esoteric or otherwise, that was the ultimate knowing, and that when you knew that knowing, it was it. That was over. And after many, many years of never finding that, and, you know, doggedly holding on to certain things, even beyond when, when it was getting really clear it wasn't so, I began to realize that my whole approach to finding the truth was wrong, and that it wasn't something you know. It wasn't knowledge you gained. It was a direct revelation that could not really be explained. And in its presence, it's as if everything else gets transformed. It's like any position you might take, any idea that you might have, any ideology you might adhere to, is temporary. It's transient. It can work in one moment and then not work in the next and completely and totally fail. What does this have to do with spiritual medicine? Well, if we look at medicine in the big picture, not pills, and not even, you know, healthy life and, and preventative stuff, and you know, eating well and exercising and taking care of ourselves and avoiding toxic substances and the like. That's part of it too. But there's the bigger meaning of medicine is just the remedy to humanity's ills, to humanity's difficulties. It was no accident that both Christ and the Buddha were referred to as the great physician. And one of my favorite books of all time is Conversations with Nisargadatta Maharaj, called The Ultimate Medicine. And so this idea of medicine being more than a fix, that it actually being a much deeper a perception of things, has deep roots in Aboriginal tribes, the medicine wheel of the North American Indians. And they even refer to various kinds of medicine, and they had the medicine man. And he wasn't a doctor, he was a shaman, he was a wise one, sometimes a she. And that wisdom was about, was not transient. It was a place of perception that was so powerful that it could actually move through all perceptions without being colored or tainted. It was kind of a vehicle through which we would travel life, on which we would travel. And of course, in Buddhism, they call it the Mahayana, which means the ultimate vehicle, the final vehicle, the great vehicle that carries you to the other side. And even to this day, the Aboriginals will refer to the shamanic journey and that involves medicine, and they refer to peyote and ayahuasca as medicine, not as a drug. We think of it as a drug, as an altered state of consciousness. And so the remedy for everything, the absolute remedy for everything, lies in the deep spiritual inquiry into our own souls, which is the only place that truth can actually emerge. And it's interesting, because even after all these years of teaching and all of this, the students that come to me initially are always seeking knowledge, and I don't turn people away, because that's exactly what I did. I thought it was knowledge. I thought I was trying to gain something to know, some information that my mind could wrap itself around and go, oh, this is good, this is good, this is really good, this is true, this is consistently true, this works, I can apply this, as if truth was some kind of a possession of mind. It was an app, right, that I was going to run on my phone. It was going to make my life easier. I mean, if it's really a truth worth knowing, it's a truth about me. It's the truth of my being that I'm after. And that's not just a thought, is it? And I would invite, comments and inquiry into this, because this idea of truth as the ultimate medicine, as spirit, as the ultimate medicine, I'll talk a little bit more about spirit in a second, is deeply profound and deeply powerful. And this idea that it is some kind of a revelation within us rather than knowledge gained is pretty novel. I mean, everything is presented in knowledge, right? School is knowledge. You have various schools of wisdom and schools of ancient wisdom and, schools of non-duality. And we have all sorts of different schools, right? But the direct experience of truth, of the spirit that is your very life, where can that come from? Somewhere outside? I mean, if it's a truth, it's a truth of you. And I say that with a big smile on my face. It's either is you, or there's no such thing. But clearly, you are. Clearly, you're here. Clearly, you're hearing my words. You're seeing this picture. If you're listening on the radio, you're whatever you're seeing in the room around you. You are having experience. There's something that is conscious, something that is there, something that is self-aware. And I always like to try to, you know, point out that, you know, I'm sitting here speaking, and I'm speaking through, you know, the jaw and the larynx, and my mouth and tongue are moving, and words are coming out, but yet my tongue isn't hearing my voice, my mouth isn't hearing it. I'm speaking into this nice microphone. The microphone isn't hearing my voice. It's converting it into a signal, and it's running through these cables, and the cables plug into other cables, and they go into the mixer, which plugs into more cables, and it goes out through another cable to the internet, and it's zooming around the world, and it's, you know, hitting your phone, or it's hitting your computer, and it's coming out your speakers, and the internet's not hearing my voice, the mixer's not hearing my voice, your speaker's not hearing my voice, you know, the headset you're wearing isn't hearing my voice. I mean, just keep going. Is your eardrum that's vibrating, is that hearing the voice? The little nerves that are converting to electricity, are they hearing your voice? What's hearing it? What's going, Is it just a functioning of your brain? Is the brain hearing your voice? Now, this is where it gets really, really interesting. You know, the neurology of the brain is really very, very fascinating. Because, you know, we think about the neocortex, right, as being this place of our consciousness, you know, conscious center and all that. But when it's actually examined, we find that all sorts of different parts of the brain react to different stimuli, to different things that are happening. And that there is no central part. There's no center place where it all comes together. And we go, All the views they've done of the brain through MRI and the like, they don't show any of that. None of it. It's all happening all over the place. They can find no center. They can find nothing that would be regarded as consciousness. So what's hearing me? There's clearly a sense of being that's there. Well, that is why I love the word spirit and spiritual. Because spiritual has been kind of diluted down to a certain class of information. You know, if it gets diluted even more, they call it religious behavior and religious rules and all that kind of stuff. And there's a better version of religion by all means. But what is spirit? To me, spirit is a completely different substance. It is consciousness that is non-local. It is non-physical. It doesn't occupy space and time. It's not a thing you can point at. And yet that is what hears my words, sees the sights, and experiences the feelings. It's that which sees your thoughts go by, which feels all the feelings, and that notices all of the conditioned pattern and responses, that all of the sensations, all of it is registering someplace that in fact is not in the brain, but is in fact spirit. And it's this spirit, this consciousness that is moving, you know, firing these synapses and moving this jaw and vibrating this larynx and, you know, making this air vibrate and going into this microphone. That's the spirit too, the source of it, the source energy and the ultimate destination and energy appear to be absolutely the same. Now just ponder that for a moment. Now, what I've given you is information, but there's nothing in that information that will be of any value to you unless you say, I wonder, and begin to look at it for yourself. Go ahead and look. Do the research. You know, watch some TED Talks. Read some some stuff about neurology. Look at all the kind the findings that they've had, both just you know, in even the strict materialists or you know consciousness people and people like me who are a little bit more out there, and look for yourself and say, is there a consciousness in the body? Am I nothing more than a complex functions of a bunch of synapses firing, and with the illusion of a self, the illusion of being someone? Is that what I am? And let that question become important enough to you that it thoroughly engages your heart and mind. Because if it doesn't, then it will become an interesting intellectual curiosity. But consider, let me make a case for this. Let me put on my evangelist's hat and make a case for this, because you realize, and this is why I call it spiritual medicine, you realize that the view of you being a physical person, a combination of all these elements, maybe at best a soul that you know resides in this body and then resides in another body and then resides in the body. Even the soul is basically just another form, another kind of person, another limited thing. That assumption is driving everything that's going on in the world. Now, if this assumption is true, why is the world so messed up? If our fundamental premise is true, shouldn't humanity like be better? I mean, if our model of the universe is right, I mean, why are we cruel to each other? Why are we barbaric? Why is there still war? Why are people making wars just in order to profit? Why are people profiting off of misery? Why are we cruel? Why are we unfeeling? Why are we harming the planet, the animals, and ourselves? Why? If this truth that we live by is so wonderful, is so significant, is really true. Now many will say it is, but look again, look very, very closely. You realize in all of history, there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever of human beings being unnecessarily cruel. None. As a matter of fact, it was exactly the opposite. There was minimum hierarchies, minimum organization for the millions of years we wandered the plains as the hunter-gatherers. You know, the average lifespan of the hunter-gatherer was 72. I mean, in the industrial age, you know, it dropped like, you know, in agriculture, when we became agriculture, working the fields and all that. And the average work week was 20 hours, by the way. Okay? Survival was a part-time job. And when we went into agriculture about 12,000 years ago, and all of a sudden we had to work a whole lot harder, we had got the idea of property and ownership, and scarcity became a concept. We needed to protect things, and it was in this period of time that not only did we start wars and skirmishes and fights and hierarchy and patriarchy and all of those things, but we also didn't live as long. You know, lifespan dropped to like 30 years, 30, 35, 40 years old. So really, if this is so good, why is everything it touches turn so bad? I mean, I just invite people to look at this stuff through open eyes, and to get interested in it, because this is your life. You are literally acting out these fundamental beliefs. I mean, if you believe yourself to be scarce and lacking and separate and isolated, then you are. Not because you really are, but because that's how powerful our minds are, that they can create the experience of something that actually isn't even there. And we don't even need those special 3D glasses and sensory suits and all of that stuff to do it. My God, we got the hardware built right here that's quite capable of doing it. And that's exactly what we do. And we're stuck in that matrix until we begin to question it. And the spiritual approach that I take, and the approach of real spiritual teachers, is to challenge the most fundamental assumptions, not look for spiritual knowledge, which is really just kind of a different way of looking at the same thing, you know, as to how this spiritual knowledge would affect what we really regard to be as real, but actually question what we think is real, what we really believe to be true. And go, okay, well, if that's true, there should be some evidence in that. Let me find the evidence in that. And then eventually, as the evidence just compounds that it's not true, things begin to fall away. A deep vision begins to arise within you. And you find that there is something that's absolutely unmistakable, unavoidable, unchangeable, and the buck seems to stop there. And that's the simple question I ask: who is hearing my words? What is it that's actually experiencing everything? Even the, you know, the 3D illusion we might be creating. We may be experiencing a 3D illusion, but somebody's experiencing it. The illusion may be completely bogus, but the one experiencing it isn't. Something is there. I always invite, just please consider that. And let me just check really quick here to see if there's anything in the queue for questions. Oh, wow. This is a great one. What is the difference between the direct experience of God and the relationship with God offered by Christianity and Buddhism? Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Who's that? Buddha's brain. Thank you, Buddha's brain. Okay, first off, the direct experience of God is what was offered by Buddha and Christ. But because it wasn't really understood, it got reduced. And in the case of Christ, just because of where it happened in history and the like, in the Nicene Council in 325 AD, it got adapted to the uses, basically the plundering of the Roman Empire. And therefore, it was that council under Constantine that decided what was going to be the official holy writ. And you know, the decisions were primarily political. It became a mechanism of mind control, that so they could manage an incredibly far-flung empire that they just simply didn't have all the resources and soldiers to police everywhere. And turns out to be a very effective method to do it. So that has nothing to do with Christ and his teachings. And that's at the far end of the spectacle. In between is a reduction of the teachings. All religious experience, all of it, started with the direct realization of God. Including the Judaism with the I Am, which is one of the most profound stories of all time. Moses discovering God as the sense I Am. When I said, who's hearing these words? It is the sense of I Am. And Moses recognized that in fact was God. Of course, when you get that, you realize that you are always experiencing God. You're never not experiencing God. And the distinction between you and God becomes increasingly faint. That line becomes increasingly blurred. More on that. If somebody wants me to go there. But let's just start that the direct experience of God. And of course, that's always what the Buddha pointed back to. That Buddha nature, the true Buddha, was you, the direct experience of God. Now, in Buddhism, they didn't refer to it as a God. They referred to it, and he even called it no self, because he was completely taking apart all of the common ideas about being a self and an ultimate self. And in that tradition, it was Brahman the creator, Brahman, Vishnu, and Shiva. So very few grasped it at that level. You can go right to that. Even as I say those words, that the sense of I Am, the one who's actually hearing my words and speaking them, is that God, the only being that there is. because very what we back off a little bit, right? And we start beginning preparing the ground. And so Buddha had all sorts of different ways of teaching that, starting with the Four Noble Truths of Suffering. There's suffering, there's a cause to suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a means to that end, which was the Eightfold Path. And Christ also did it through good works, through kindness, acts of compassion, through unselfish giving, through peacemaking. You know, the entire thing known as the Beatitudes, being meek, being humble, taking the lower seat at the, not being haughty, putting love and charity above self-interest, taking care of the poor, healing the sick. Those are all of the things that Christ said. That was the path. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall see God. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. I can't remember which one it was. Blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. They shall be called the children of God, the very emanation of God itself, the very presence of God. And we find that in the Hindu tradition. We have the various yogas, the Seva Yoga and Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. And there's all sorts of different, as well as Hatha Yoga and Jnana Yoga. There's six altogether. I can't remember them all. Raja Yoga. They were all different ways of beginning to approach this. These are all the different paths that all led to the same place. And the same place is the ultimate direct experience of God. So religions, the relationship with God is one that becomes increasingly loving, increasingly tender, increasingly devotional. You know, if you're in love with somebody, you give them the shirt off your back, you know? You die for them, right? I mean, the person you love, their happiness is more important than yours. That's the kind of relationship that becomes increasingly intimate and more intimate and more intimate. And there's more of a willingness to sacrifice your own ego and your own ideas of what's true as you find that this very same self-same God is the truth itself. And as you begin to realize how deceived you've been by that, the egoic sense of identity, all of this brings you closer and closer until finally you disappear. Lord, replace me with you. Thou art the love with which I love thee. And the ultimate spiritual experience is you disappear and all there is God. This is not the same as people think. There's a lot of people saying, you know, oh, I've realized that I am God. We're all one, and therefore I am God. Usually that's, you could tell just by the sound of it when somebody says something like that. It's an egoic sense. It's kind of the ego hanging out. It's a spiritualized version of the ego, maybe even a very good one, you know, very well behaved. But it's still egoic in nature because you can't have two anymore. So everything you're doing, you may be chanting mantras, you may just be trying to live a good life, you may be, you know, devoted to Christ, you may be devoted to Allah or Muhammad, you know, wherever that devotion lies, wherever your particular practice takes you, it's taking you ultimately to the same place. And the only mistake we make is that we mistake the form truth is taking for the truth itself. And we don't know when it's time to let go of the form and fall more deeply into the essence. Because all the forms are cultural, they're all temporary, they're all provisional, which Buddha himself said, you know, you take a boat, you take it across the lake to the other side. When you get to the other side, you don't pick it up and carry it around with you. You know, you're done. You leave it for the next person. You now carry on without it. You are done with that. And in the Heart Sutra, which I've actually included some parts of in my inner reconciliation training, that's exactly what the entire thing is. As I mentioned, he created all sorts of different teachings. to cover all sorts of different states of mind. And in the Heart Sutra, he systematically undoes every one of those teachings, every one of them, until you're left with absolutely nothing but the pure, absolute awareness of being itself, which is what in other traditions is called God. Let's see something. So they're saying, is it too loud on Facebook? I've got it pulled way, way back. I hope it's not on the Facebook feed. Let's see. Does praying to God reinforce dualistic thinking? Whenever you pray from the mind, you are reinforcing dualistic thinking. But if you pray with your heart, it doesn't. It actually is kind of the solvent that begins to dissolve the dualistic thinking. You know, the dualistic thinking will put its tentacles in everywhere. You know, I mean, we pray to a God, there's obviously a duality there. But again, I always want to look at the heart of someone rather than just the thoughts of them, because yes, there is a duality in prayer. I remember early on in my spiritual development, I would pray, and over time the prayer matured, and became prayers of affirmations. As I became more aware of what the truth actually was, I was doing these prayers of affirmation, which was part of the metaphysical tradition, and they actually heal, right? You assert firm health for where there appears to be sickness, and it actually works. It heals. It is a medicine of sorts. And I just remember doing that, and the more I did it, the more it began to dawn on me that whatever I was doing was already known. Whatever I was asking, whatever I was thinking, whatever I was intending on doing in that moment was already known by God. It's God knows what you're going to ask for before you ask. And as I began to realize that, you know, why don't I just, instead of even trying to affirm or supplicate or ask for something, I just decided maybe I ought to just shut up and listen. And that's what I did. I just was quiet. And at first, my mind did not like that at all. It wanted to do something. And for a while, I would. But, you know, then I would just, no, let's just see what happens. I mean, really, I mean, everything I'm doing is really almost for my entertainment, you know, to convince me. You certainly don't need to convince truth of what the truth is. And so I became increasingly quiet. And as a result, I ended up falling into meditation, which is simply a listening. Now, it was still dualistic because I was listening to it because I had the idea of God as truth and that I was I was no longer this, you know, bounded form anymore, but, you know, it was God's idea at that point. I mean, duality was still alive and well. But what happened for me, though, is that even though I later learned formal meditation of various kinds, that I never lost that initial religious sentiment about it, the feeling of prayer in it. So it didn't become an intellectual thing. It didn't become something I was just trying to, you know, reduce stress and control my mind and that sort of thing. There was another heart to it I never forgot. And the more I practiced it and the more I got to know others and eventually teach it, I found that was kind of a big mistake, that there wasn't enough heart in it. There wasn't enough really just allowing and accepting and inner compassion for oneself and just a willingness to be totally present even with the most unpleasant and uncomfortable things. And that the more I could do that, the clearer it would get and the quieter it would get. And in that quiet, I found duality didn't exist. Whenever I think about it in my mind, of course, the mind is dualistic by nature, right? So you can't think non-duality. We can approach it. We can point to it. We can suggest things about it, you know, because we can, if the mind's well-trained, it can walk right up to its perimeter, as far as it can go, and it can look a little further and see there's something beyond this. And it actually looks pretty vast, but the mind itself can't go beyond it. And of course, that's the big point when you realize you have to rely on something completely different in order to understand and approach the truth. So I hope that answers your question about it. Again, it's a really big continuum, and to judge yourself, look at your heart, right? Just look at the kind of things that you're pursuing. As Christ said, you know, where your heart is, there will your treasure be also. And where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Watch what it is you're pursuing. And for a lot of people, the pursuit of meditation and spiritual practices is an improved life, which is really, really good. But let it get even deeper. Let yourself want to know, really know in your heart. Know as in intimate knowledge, as in, you know, like the way you know your hands, right? Let that be the kind of knowing that you pursue with all of your heart, with all of your soul. And I hope that answers it. Let me check out the queue here again. Hey, GP. Hi. Hey, Sean. I'm absolutely aware of the pain happening in my innards. I don't know why teachers don't ask about dealing with other people's judgments about us. Or why don't talk about dealing with other people's judgments about us? Well, I don't want to speak about it in general terms, but other people's judgments of me. I have lots of people. If you look at some of the comments I get on YouTube, I've been called a lot of stuff. I've been, you know, summarily dismissed in that, especially when I talk about neurology and things like that. I mean, the strict materialist finds what I'm saying actually absolutely offensive. But what I would really talk about is, okay, somebody's judgment of you, tell me what that does to you. What does that mean to you? How does that feel to you? Because just talking about it in general terms, I mean, people are going to judge, period. You know, I don't care who you are. You know, Christ was crucified, for crying out loud, one of the kindest, gentlest people to ever walk the planet, right? So the story goes. So it's not like everybody's going to, you know, like people are always going to judge you. They're going to see everything through their lens. Their perspective is going to determine everything, just like yours does. So you see people as being judgmental. Well, that's a perception you have of them. And that simply means their view of things contradicts yours. But the rubber meets the road when you go, is this hurting me? Do I feel pain about that? Do I feel diminished? And that has got meat to it. That we can deal with. That we can look at, because now it's not just an idea we're discussing, it's life. To me, this is the medicine, right? Medicine is not theory. We don't sit around and talk about medicine. You take medicine, right? Doctors say, this is a great medicine. What do you think? You show little charts and diagrams, and it's a wonderful thing, and it really goes well with your symptoms. Isn't this wonderful? This is really good. And you never take it, right? That's kind of what we do when we talk about these things theoretically. What I highly recommend is that you just say, okay, and look at some event in specific, especially if there's something right now going on in your life. There's somebody in your life who's very judgmental. Right? And it can be somebody close, very close to you. It could be, you know, your spouse, right? Or somebody else you love, somebody in your family that you just can't, you know, you just can't kick them to the curb, right? And then put all of your attention on that feeling of being judged, about being diminished, about being belittled, and see what's there. Why in the world would somebody else's perception of you have any effect? The reality is it doesn't. Nobody's judgment of you could possibly have an effect. Only your thoughts about it can have an effect on you. Only your thoughts. You say this judgment hurts. The judgment doesn't hurt. No judgment hurts. Your thought about the judgment, your belief about the judgment hurts. That is causing the pain and not the judgment itself. So while most people would try to like get people to not judge me, explain themselves, try to make everything clear, resolve it, I say, forget all that. It's a waste of time. If there's a difference between you that to be resolved, it's only going to be resolved when the pain in you is gone. And you realize how powerful that is. When you are no longer pushed around by other people's ideas or feelings or thoughts or considerations, and are completely poised within yourself, recognizing that it's only you that can hurt you, think how powerful you become. Think of what a force of good you become. Just ponder that for a moment. Nothing out there can hurt you. Only your thoughts about yourself can hurt you. And that's the final truth. That's the ultimate medicine. That knowledge is the ultimate medicine. It's the ultimate cure-all. Now, that doesn't mean somebody says something hurtful and it's not going to sting. I'm not saying this is, you know, this makes you immune from feeling. What it does is make you immune from the story about the feelings. It makes you immune from self-created problems and the perpetuation of them. Yeah, somebody judges you, somebody says something nasty. You know, I get the things. I should dig some of them up and read them to you. I mean, some are just really downright nasty. What can I expect? You know, I've got 250,000 views on YouTube. I have to expect some people going, gee, you're full of shit, right? I got to expect it, right? And nastier things things than that. And I feel the sting, and then it's gone. It passes through, you know, because I want to be understood. You know, I want to engage people in this kind of inquiry. I'm not trying to push truth on anybody. I'm trying to engage you in inquiry. Just look for yourself. You don't hear me out trying to spout truth. I'm inviting you to look for yourself. Even what I just said, look for yourself. Am I really in pain because it was somebody said or because of my reaction to it and the weight I gave to it? And that means I can give less weight to it. Consider it, look at it, but not take it as if, oh, I've got what done, so why you said I've got. And just go, oh, okay, I get it, all right. And sometimes there's even truth in it, and sometimes just your ego wanting to defend itself. And, you know, frankly, if the ego gets a good whacking, thank God, you know? Yeah, you know, it's, you know, it's, you know, until you're a Buddha, make sure you've always got people around you going to give you good whacking, give you a good challenge. As Ram Dass said, If you want to test to see whether you're enlightened or not, go spend a week with your family. it's a great litmus test. Yeah. So let's see what else is in there. Let's see. Thank you. Makes me question myself. Not quite sure what you mean by that. I'm hoping you mean in the good way, and not doubt yourself. Right? Doubt who you think you are. Always doubt that. That's what Buddhists refer to as the great doubt. Never swallow whole what everybody thinks you are or what you have thought yourself to be. Always challenge those. That's how we grow, right? That's how we make sure that we're not stuck in a position. This, you know, I see this happen all the time after all these years of teaching all sorts of different techniques. And I see it happen a lot in people in personal development and law of attraction, like, something really worked well for them. It's a technique they learned. God, it was really successful. Oh, they manifested like everything, right? I mean, they just think of it and it appeared, you know, the Red Sea was parting in front of them. It was always constant bliss. And all of a sudden it stopped working. And of course the proponents, the one teaching it, say, well, it's your thinking, right? It must be that. And of course, if you're doggedly set that this is the approach, then that's exactly what you're going to think. Oh, that's my thinking. So I got to work even harder. Well, I did that for a while. Redoubled my efforts. I lived like a monk for a while. I mean, I was so disciplined. I was so, not one thought escaped me, and it didn't work. I said, what the hell's going on? Is it really just me? Is this an endless loop that I'm just never going to get it? Or is this a provisional teaching? Is it not working because it's not supposed to work anymore? I'm supposed to move on to something else. Remember, you know, just notice that when somebody holds on to something doggedly, that's where we get fundamentalism. That's where we get nationalism. That's where we get anger and war and fights and all sorts of people defending a position. You know, our modern day wars aren't, they're not about survival. They're about defending an ideology. I mean, really, think about it. We're defending a bunch of thoughts. And we're willing to blow things up and cause enormous misery in the defense of these thoughts. Isn't it really worthwhile to kind of question those? So if something's not working in your life, don't immediately say, I'm doing something wrong. There's something wrong with me. I need to work even harder at this. Sometimes you do. Sometimes, you know, you slacked off. You just need a little adjustment here and there. But sometimes truth is calling you to a higher level. Remember, even Buddha dismantled and dissolved every single one of his teachings. He said every teaching is provisional. There's no such thing as an eternal truth in a teaching. They are all pointers to the ultimate truth, which is this pure, empty, infinite, vast beingness. It is beyond what even words can possibly describe, but you don't have to describe it because you are it. Make sure. Oh, you know, I completely forgot to give the number again. Done. Duh. Got like 5 minutes here. Somebody wants to call in. The number is 888-627-6008. Remember, that number to call is 888-627-6008. Operator standing by. Back in the days, I used to do voiceovers. So, any other like questions? Let's see. I'm just saying thank you. Got it. Thank you all. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Kind of quiet on the questions today. That's okay. Any more questions coming up for people? If not, I'm sure something will come to me to say, but I love it when I can address things in specific. Things just kind of come. The medicine that I offer is the medicine of spirit. The medicine of a very light and a very sweet inner exploration. A willingness to simply be who you are. GP, can you return to the topic of cruelty? Sorry, I can't see very well. When we have awareness of the world, of it in the world, where can we put our attention to be a force of good, to change or influence it? Yeah. This is kind of a complex one because it perplexes many people, and spiritual teachers like myself have been criticized for not being more of an activist. And I do have political views, but what I try to do is I try to point people to the to the essential. And the essential is that everything going on in the world is coming from a distorted perception of reality, that is, of the self. It is coming from the mistaken belief of a separate self, and out of that separate self arises a fear of death and a fear of lack, the belief in scarcity. The entire systems of the world are based on the idea of scarcity. And scarcity is not true. There is no scarcity. And I can examine it on multiple levels, right? It's both spiritually, personally, socially, and even physically in terms of the characteristics of the earth. But it is that belief that creates fear. And that fear is what's driving us. Now, here's how you begin to get to a position that is a peacemaker. The ones who are suffering, who are going without, have been deprived, who have been really marginalized, pushed to the side, lost their homes because there's this, you know, fight over resources, which is really a fight over wealth. Our hearts naturally go out to them. And then we turn towards, you know, the greedy corporations and governments and stuff that are doing it, the tiny fraction of people who are controlling most of the wealth. And we impute this horrible greed and stuff on them. But what I like to draw people's attention to is that both sides are looking at the world through the same eyes, through the eyes of scarcity. And these guys, being more powerful, have hoarded more, they've grabbed more, they're trying to hold on to more, they want it all for themselves. And of course that, you know, lets other people out. And in this universal idea of scarcity, we don't understand how things actually work so that we could eliminate scarcity. I mean, there's no reason for it to be here anymore. There never really was. You know, there were the fluctuations of nature, but nobody felt like there was scarcity. And so we impute, you know, victimhood on this hand, and then and greed and perpetrator on the other. And both are living under the same delusion. And if we can see that, compassion for both sides begins to emerge, and we realize that it is only wisdom. It is only a deeper seeing. And the sacrifice and the elimination of ego that comes from that deeper seeing that will solve any of the problems. It's not merely structural. It'll create, if we have this wisdom, it'll create different structures, different systems, different politics, different organization, right? Which is what we seek to do. But without that, even the attempt to create different structures will just meet with more conflict, and it'll be more of the same, because the essential conflict is in this perspective. And believe me, if you feel threatened, if you really feel as if you're threatened, that's the only time human beings become cruel. And the cruelty is simply just a violence born out of the fear of surviving, which eventually becomes, you know, the fear of power. I want to have it all. I mean, it's very elaborate. I don't want to try to go into the whole thing. It's not really all that important. Get to the heart of it. Because when you have that wisdom, you become the light. When you are no longer taking sides because you realize both of those sides are wrong, both of those are suffering from the same fundamental error, you see the fundamental error, you are now the light of wisdom. And in some way, it's going to emerge in your personal life, in the way you interact. You don't even have to say anything. You don't have to make speeches. You know, you may be led to. You may become the next Martin Luther King. We don't know, right? Fine, the next Gandhi. You just very well might, right? But they were wise. You can see it in their eyes. You can hear it in their words. They weren't just reacting. They saw the essential crisis, the essential thing. And so they didn't harbor ill feelings for either side, but they saw the potential for cruelty and the potential for victimhood. And they sat smack dab in the middle. that's where they positioned themselves. And of course, it's the untenable position. It's the position they want to wipe out because, you know, that is the truth. And everything gets seen in that truth. And yes, it's not the most popular position. It's because it's the right one. That answers your question. That does it for you, Carrie Lee, because it's a very important one, and it's one I'm actually going to be doing a class I'm thinking about in November that I'm going to be calling the Delusion of Scarcity, and it's going to be a big one. I'm thinking like 4 or 5 days long. It's going to be really involved because I want to cover this in every single aspect. Underneath it is this sense of not being one with the truth. And the truth is your spiritual medicine. So, folks, it is, as always, it's been such an honor to be hanging out here with you for an hour on Sunday. I hope you've gotten a lot out of this, and I hope it touches your heart, and I hope you'll join me next week and check out Facebook/Inner Reconciliation is the page that I'm that is going to become the focal point for everything, and or innerreconciliation.com, and you can get a free course. And I think the free course online, it's a 2-hour workshop. It's not a little thing. There's a link for it too on Facebook. So thank you once again. Love you all.